aquest seminari sobre memòria, política i patrimoni que organitzem des de l'Institut Català de Recerca en Patrimoni Cultural en el marc d'aquestes trobades anuals que s'organitzen conjuntament amb Caixa de Girona. La idea general, l'objectiu d'aquests seminaris de patrimoni és poder comptar amb la presència entre nosaltres de persones, de personalitats, d'investigadors de primer nivell internacional amb temàtiques que d'una o d'altra manera es relacionen amb el patrimoni i poder, diguem-ne, amb elles, diguem-ne, tractar temes d'interès actual relacionades amb el patrimoni cultural. Les conferències del seminari que comencem ara estaran impartides pel professor Andreas Huysen i abans que res, diguem-ne, voldríem agrair en nom de l'Institut, diguem-ne, que Andreas Huysen hagués acceptat la invitació a participar en aquest seminari. És realment un privilegi per nosaltres poder comptar amb la seva presència aquests dies a Girona. I voldríem també, diguem-ne, agrair a la doctora Paz Moreno i a Maria Jesús Bono el fet de també haver acceptat, diguem-ne, la invitació de poder participar en aquest seminari. Andreas Huysen teniu el currículum una mica detallat en un document a la carpeta que se us ha entregat. Ell és professor de literatura alemanya i comparada a la Universitat de Columbia. Va ser el director i el fundador del Centre de Literatura Comparada d'aquesta universitat. Ha estat director en cap del Departament de Llengües Germàniques també d'aquesta universitat i, diguem-ne, té una dilatadíssima massa de publicacions, diguem-ne, vinculades, una part d'elles, diguem-ne, els temes de memòria, l'estudi de la memòria cultural en els traumes històrics, i és una mica, diguem-ne, en aquest marc, diguem-ne, pel qual a nosaltres ens ha interessat i li hem demanat que pogués estar amb nosaltres. Com us deia, diguem-ne, té moltes publicacions en alemany i en anglès, i la seva obra ha estat també traduïda al castellà, al portuguès, al suec, al danès, al turc, al japonès i al xinès, i li agraïm també, diguem-ne, que ens permetrà de publicar a l'Institut una de les seves conferències i, per tant, diguem-ne, a la llista hi podrem afegir també el català d'obres traduïdes seves. A la carpeta i en els fulls teniu també un breu recull d'algunes de les seves obres que ens han semblat que podien ser més interessants i també, diguem-ne, algunes informacions, diguem-ne, que podeu trobar a la xarxa sobre Andreas Huysen. També, com us deia, ens acompanya Paz Moreno. Paz Moreno és catedràtica d'Antropologia al Departament d'Antropologia de la Universitat Nacional d'Educació a Distància a Madrid, on imparteix docència en temes d'antropologia econòmica. Ella, com a antropòloga, ha estat treballant en els camps de l'antropologia econòmica, en temes d'identitat, temes de nacionalisme, temes d'oralitat, d'economia del sagrat, etc. Té també moltíssimes publicacions i una mica, diguem-ne, la part, diguem-ne, de la seva recerca que ens interessa o que per la qual li hem demanat que pogués venir a aquest seminari, és que ella també, diguem-ne, s'ha, des d'un punt de vista etnogràfic, de l'etnologia, s'ha, diguem-ne, ha estat també estudiant temes vinculats a la memòria i especialment temes vinculats al que havien estat els camps de concentració nazis. Ha treballat temes sobre la vida quotidiana en aquests camps, sobre l'economia política a l'interior d'aquests camps, sobre les jerarquies en aquests camps i, per tant, diguem-ne, també la seva presència ens sembla, doncs, de primera importància de que pugui estar entre nosaltres. També ens acompanyarà Maria Jesús Bono, una mica amb la idea de també, donat que estem aquests dies parlant de memòria, doncs una mica també potser de posar, diguéssim, aquest punt a veure una mica en el nostre entorn més proper què s'està fent, almenys des del govern. Per això, diguem-ne, ens va semblar que era interessant demanar-li a Maria Jesús Bono, i ella molt amablement ha acceptat, de poder estar aquí entre nosaltres. Ella és actualment la directora general de memòria democràtica de la Generalitat dintre del Departament d'Interior, i una mica la seva aportació serà fer una exposició i un balanç una mica de les actuacions d'aquesta direcció general. Una mica la idea general del seminari d'avui és aquesta, no? Que en moltes parts del món ja no estem assistint a aquest increment de l'interès de la memòria, de la memòria històrica, i també, diguem-ne, en el nostre país potser, diguem-ne, també més relacionat amb el que van estar els anys de la Guerra Civil i els anys del franquisme, i aquest interès, diguem-ne, cap a la memòria històrica, cap a la recuperació de la memòria històrica, ha comportat també una determinada valoració d'alguns elements del patrimoni cultural entesos com elements que poden il·lustrar o exemplificar aquesta memòria. Aquesta recuperació de la memòria i aquesta també valorització d'uns elements del patrimoni cultural respon, com segur sabem, a uns determinats interessos i a uns determinats models, i una mica en aquest sentit és que la memòria i també les activacions del patrimoni cultural ens sembla, diguem-ne, que és absolutament necessari, diguem-ne, d'aprofundir en la seva reflexió i aprofundir en el seu anàlisi, una mica del per què i el què de tot això. Per tant, una mica aquest seria, diguem-ne, l'objectiu d'aquest seminari, d'alguna manera contribuir a la nostra mesura, a la possible mesura, a aquesta reflexió sobre aquesta situació. Pel que fa referència al programa, segueix exactament el que estava previst en el fulletó. Aquest matí, en dues parts, hi hauria, amb una pausa, que prendríem un cafè entremig, i hi hauria una primera sessió d'Andreas Huyssen sobre Nemo Història, un nou paradigma. Després del cafè faríem la segona sessió sobre textos clàssics sobre la memòria. Reprendríem a la tarda en Paz Moreno amb unes conferències sobre les sales judicials com a lloc de memòria, i la darrera sessió de la tarda la faria l'Andreas Huyssen amb el tema resistència a la memòria, usos i abusos de l'oblit públic. Demà una mica continuaríem també amb el mateix programa, començaríem amb Andreas Huyssen, la primera conferència sobre la nostàlgia de les ruïnes, la segona conferència del matí seria la Maria Jesús Bono, que ens exposarà el Memorial Democràtic a Catalunya, i a la tarda hi hauria les dues darreres conferències de l'Andreas Huyssen, el punt mort de la memòria, i la darrera, discursos transnacionals de la memòria. Per tant, res més, agrair altra vegada la presència de l'Andreas Huyssen entre nosaltres, de la Paz Moreno i de la Maria Jesús Bono, que s'incorporarà més tard, i doncs donar pas a la seva conferència. Moltes gràcies.
Muy bien, muchas gracias per la introducció, Gabriel, i també quisiera agradecer al Instituto Catalán de Investigaciones en Patrimonio Cultural per esta invitació. Me encanta estar aquí en Girona, que no conocía. Hace muchísimos años que he hecho algunos estudios de idioma castellano, en ese tiempo, claro, en Barcelona, pero no tenía ocasión de venir en ese tiempo a Girona. Entonces estoy muy feliz de estar aquí. Como programa, estas primeras dos conferencias son más bien informales, y las voy a hacer en inglés, porque mi castellano, como ya entienden, no es bastante bueno para hacer esas cosas un poco más complicadas en castellano. Y las otras conferencias, yo no tengo un texto más formal, y las puedo dar en castellano. Entonces me disculpo, pero esta mañana será en inglés. Bueno, y la división de las dos conferencias, la primera será sobre un tema, el tema metodológico, la relación entre memoria e historia, que siempre es un gran problema, especialmente para historiadores, para otros también. Y la segunda, voy a hablar de algunos textos clave que yo he utilizado en mi enseñanza, textos que a mí me parecen ser muy importantes para toda esta discusión. Entonces, déjame empezar con la primera. Nemo History, a New Paradigm. En En 1988, y los traductores, dígame, tell me if I'm going too fast, okay? You'll go like that if you want slower. In 1988, shortly before the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, the German Egyptologist Jan Assmann suggested a new paradigm for the human sciences. It was a paradigm organized around issues of memory. In a book entitled Kultur und Gedächtnis, Culture and Memory, and in his subsequent work, he made a number of useful distinctions that went beyond the memory sociology of Halbwachs, of Maurice Halbwachs, about whom I'll speak a little in the second session. I mean, Halbwachs, as I'm sure you know, had opposed collective memory on the one hand, collective memory meaning communicative, generational memory within a limited time horizon of 2, maximum 3 generations. He had opposed collective memory to history. History meaning, of course, at this context, historiography. Now, Assmann then made a further distinction between communicative memory, which he saw primarily as oral memory, generational memory, the conversation among generations, on the one hand, and cultural memory, what he called cultural memory being manifest in cultural products, among other things, such as artworks, architecture, literary works. So in certain ways, it was an opposition between the oral dimension, communicative memory, and the written or embodied dimension, cultural memory. Now, this attempt to introduce new distinctions into this old field of study, described as collective memory, proved to be very influential. And indeed, much of my own published work on memory is not on oral memory, generational memory, but it is on cultural memory. I mean, my background, as you may know, is in literary criticism and some art criticism and social theory. So my work has been primarily on issues of memory in artworks, in literary texts, in theory, and in architecture and urban spaces. And for me particularly, Berlin was a key kind of concern during the 1990s. So my own work is not on communicative memory, which is the domain primarily these days, of course, of oral history. And oral history, of course, is another subfield of historiography that has become, at least in the United States and also in my former own country, in Germany, has become very important in the past few decades. Anyway, I would say that what Jan Assmann describes as mnemohistory, the historiography of structures of memory in social context, mnemohistory has taken off in major ways since the late 1980s. Now, I would like to step back for a second. We need to remember, at the time in the late 1980s, the dominant paradigm in the humanities, in the social sciences, and in architecture was postmodernism. And arguably, postmodernism was more prominent at the time in the United States than in Europe, but by the 80s it had already begun to travel to France. I mean, you know Lyotard's book, La Condition Postmoderne. It had traveled to Germany, to Japan, to Latin America, and so forth. Now, postmodernism was, I think, a dominant paradigm in the humanities at that time. Now, one influential definition of postmodernism that I want to draw on briefly was the one articulated by Fred Jameson in an essay, Postmodernism or the Logic of Late Capitalism. It was an essay of 1984, which became the key essay then also in a book of the same title published a few years later. And what Jameson argued there was a division between space and time. He argued that modernism was the culture of temporality, of time. We only have to think of Proust, for instance, to know what he was getting at. Questions of temporality being central in modernist literature. whereas postmodernism, according to Jameson, was a culture of space. So there was somewhat, I'm perhaps being a little reductive, but there was a clear kind of separation which became very influential. And this separation, this definition of postmodern culture of the 1970s and 1980s as a culture of space, had of course a lot to do with architecture, because the paradigm shift from modernism to postmodernism was most visible in architecture. In the architecture of Michael Graves, of, you know, the new work of Philip, not the old, but the new work of Philip Johnson, etc., historical ornaments being used in architecture, and so forth and so on. So architecture, in a way, was a lead discourse, a leading discourse, a major discourse to define the postmodern in distinction to modernism. But this shift from time to space in Jameson, from the importance of time to the importance of space, was tied to a lament about amnesia in contemporary consumer society. Jameson made that argument. He lamented that there was no more historical consciousness. And Jameson was a North American leftist coming out of the new left of the 1960s. And so this rise of postmodernism was not something he would easily celebrate. He was not happy about it. And as you know, I mean, within Marxist discourse, of course, space was always the negative term, whereas time, temporality, was the positive term, time being related to history, to progress, to the coming of the revolution, etc., etc. So Jameson's analysis of postmodernism as a culture of space was not at all celebratory, but it remained highly ambivalent. But it was enormously influential in the 1980s and is still cited as a key text today about postmodernism. Now, why do I mention this? I mention it because the issue of temporality was not central in the postmodernism discussions in the United States. But then suddenly, temporality as a key concern came back with a vengeance in what I have called the memory boom of the 1990s and following. And this memory boom, which reaches, I think, across the world, and it includes heritage discussions, patrimony discussions, trauma discussions, etc., this memory boom has not subsided until today. Now, it posed a problem for many historians. And historians are usually very distrustful of memory. Present company excluded, of course. But I remember a discussion with Peter Gay, a sort of major European historian at Yale at the time. We had a conference on cultural history and on memory, and he just said, this was in the late 80s, early 90s, why do you people all speak about memory? Memory is nothing, this was the condescending attitude, memory is nothing but the stuff of history, the mere material of history. Another historian, colleague of mine at Columbia, Yosef Yerushalmi, wrote a book on the Jewish traditions of memory. The book is entitled Zakor. I'm sure it's translated into Spanish. And there he argued that academic historiography, at some point in the 19th century, replaced an earlier memory culture which had been alive. So there was a move from alive communal memory culture into historiography. And he was also very ambivalent about that move, although of course he himself was a historian. Since then, other historians like Charlie Mayer, a European historian at Harvard, then complained, you know, in the late 90s about what he called a surfeit of memory, an excess of memory. Just as Nietzsche, over 100 years earlier, had complained about the hypertrophy of history. For Nietzsche, there was too much history in the 19th century. For many of these historians nowadays, there is too much memory. So how then do we deal with this kind of conflict or this kind of tension between these two terms? And I think I want to start out here with a few comments about this dominant, this binary between history and memory, which was dominant for such a long time. I'm not exactly sure how the situation is here in Spain, but some conversations I've had in Barcelona these past few days suggested that there are also many historians here who, you know, sort of make a clear kind of distinction between history and memory. I mean, not all, it's never all, but it still seems to be a dominant paradigm. On the other hand, of course, there are the defenders of memory, whom I call the memorians. I mean, the historians on one hand, the memorians on the other side. The memorians who are deeply suspicious of much historiography and the claims of historiography to objectivity and the claims of historiography to political and ideological disinterestedness. So how then was this difference between history and memory coded in the past? And this old binary went something like this. I mean, I should have had a handout, but I'm sorry I don't. But anyway, so I'll just talk about it a bit. History is objective to the historians. Memory is only subjective, subjective then being the negative term. History gets at truth. You know, historians like to talk about the definitive work about this or that historical period, and then, of course, inevitably, 20 years later, there will be the next definitive work, you know, which already shows that there's a problem with this idea of the definitive work. Anyway, historians go for the truth of history. Memory produces, according to them, illusions, and is, in that sense, closer to fiction. History is scientific. Memory is merely personal. Now, the memorians, on the other hand, would say history is cold, is distanced, is heartless, and is too big. The memorians will say that memory, on the other hand, has warmth, it is emotional, and it is small, and they privilege those kinds of categories. History, they say, is merely academic, and thus has a limited range, whereas memory discourses are public and are collective. And as you know, there is a long discussion about the notion of collective memory. History, for the memorians, is abstract and inauthentic, whereas memory is concrete, it is embodied, and it is authentic. And of course, all of this, you know, what underlies the opposition also is, of course, that history is written. And as you know, the suspicions of the written text go all the way back to Plato. They have always existed. The written as destroying memory was one of Plato's arguments, whereas memory is oral and is communicative. Now, this is a binary. Of course, binaries never work. So there are always crossovers. And we do know that lived traditions, patrimony, heritage, all depend on both academic history and on embodied memory practices. So the separation of history and memory, I would argue, is a non-starter. I mean, it just does not work in a rigorous sense, and we have to think of memory and history together. And one particular disciplinarily specific way to do that is exactly this notion that Assmann tried to develop, the field of mnemohistory, which does not deny that historiographers can do other things as well. I mean, they can do political history, they can do history of dynasties, history of the church, whatever it might be. But mnemohistory would even impact those other areas, and it seems to do that today. So the question then is, you know, what really has changed, or how did this change come about? And here I would just outline a couple of dimensions that are at the roots of this critique of traditional historiography. And the critique came, you know, first from the political side. I mean, from the 1960s on, and perhaps in Spain a little bit later, social movements of the 60s and the 70s and the 80s began to challenge the notion that historiography was disinterested and objective. They challenged the idea, and they argued that traditional historiography worked top down, and the new kind of historiography began to work bottom up. I mean, you have new interest in women's history, in the history of sexuality, history of gays and lesbians, histories of minorities. So there was a political dimension which I think changed the historiographical discourse. Then there was a philosophical dimension for which I think Jean-François Lyotard came to be very important. Lyotard attacked what he called the grand narratives, les méta-récits. And the grand narratives of the past for him were hermeneutics, as in historicism, 19th century historicism. They were the philosophy of history that came out of Hegel and was continued by later Hegelians. It was the notion of teleology, another méta-récit, the teleology as in Marxism. So that was a philosophical critique. Then there was a critique that was indebted in certain ways to post-structuralism and to the theory of discourse, when, for instance, a historian by the name of Hayden White in Tropics of Discourse argued that all history operates with different modes of narration. In other words, you forget objectivity as a positivist ideal. All history tells stories. Historiography tells stories. And he then argued that history can be told in different modes. There is heroic history. I mean, the history of the great kings, the history of the great wars, etc. There is idyllic history. Idyllic history being the one that always sees the paradise in the past and the present as a problem. There is tragic history. And there's even something as comic history. And so discourse theory argued that historiography, far from being objective, has to be analyzed in its literary dimension, in its narrative literary dimensions. So there was yet another that was a third major critique of the objectivity ideal. And then you had, of course, the rise of oral history that had to do, particularly in the case of traumatic histories after radical changes in government, and also in the German case after the Holocaust, oral history that became important for the rise of, an analysis or an investigation of testimonies of the witnesses who had experienced a certain traumatic history and who were interviewed about it, whose testimonies were collected and then of course also written down. Now, back to my main argument here. Which is not just my main argument, but which I take to be a fairly large consensus, by the way, at least in the academic environment in which I work, which is to say, both history and memory produce the past. Both history and memory construct the past. They are not the same, but they cannot be hierarchically separated. There is good history, and there is bad history. There is good history and there is good memory and there is bad memory. So we're called upon to make distinctions within both memory and history. Then, of course, there are oral histories and there are written memoirs. Both history and memory practices are always multi-layered, but they cannot do without each other. Now, Assmann's term, memohistory, acknowledges that fact. It insists that social memory structures can be read and analyzed with the toolkit of historiography. And this, of course, moves historiography, the writing of history, into the realm which was described in earlier decades by the Annales school in France as histoire des mentalités, histoire des mentalités. And I would say that Pierre Nora's realms of memory, les lieux de mémoire, about which I'll speak in the second session a little more, Pierre Nora's lieux de mémoire of the 1970s and 80s stand behind the positing of memory as a serious historiographical project. And I think one can, I mean, I started here with Assmann because, not because he's German, but because I find this notion of mnemohistory very useful. But of course, Assmann's own ideas, his first book was published in 1988, could already benefit from Nora's investigations in France. So now I would say we have not only mnemohistorians, but we have mnemosociologists, mnemoliterary critics, and mnemo-media theorists. But still, there is a question. What the hell is the difference? I mean, the question is not being dealt with adequately if we say they depend on each other. What is the difference? Now, I think here I would want to... I don't think that the question, what is history or what is memory? ¿Qué es la historia? ¿Qué es la memoria? Or in terms of this famous French book series, qu'est-ce que c'est l'histoire? Qu'est-ce que c'est la mémoire? I don't think that question is a good question. I think it's a bad question. So another approach, I think, would be called for. And it is another approach that I think would go beyond the demand for a positivist definition. I would opt for historicizing the problem itself. And I will do that in the second session a little bit today by reading these several salient texts from Nietzsche to Noah. But before we get to that, let me ask another question, a question that I think is of importance not only here but across the world. Now, if it is true, and this is one of my claims, if it is true that our contemporary present in the early 21st century is characterized by a memory boom across much of the world, then we need to ask another question. What is it that produced this memory boom? Especially since the preceding decades, I mean the decades when postmodernism was a ruling paradigm, they did not care very much with the, about the question of memory at all. Now, if I'm saying that the memory boom exists across the world, I would say it clearly exists in Europe. It exists now in Spain with the issues of the memory of the Civil War. It is dominant in the Middle East in the conflicts between the Palestinians and the Israelis. It's, you know, very strong in Latin America, in the United States, in Russia, in India, in China, even in Australia. So the question becomes how, it's a historical question, how did this happen? I mean, how did we get into this situation? And so I want to do now in my perhaps last 15, 20 minutes, and then we can have a bit of discussion perhaps. We're going till 11:30, right? Hasta las 11:30. Yeah, okay, then I have a little more time. Okay. So, the emergence of memory as a key signifier in the humanities and in the social sciences was very slow. So I'm not going to say that it suddenly happened at one specific date, but the process developed in slow motion. Memory discourses of a new kind first emerged in Western countries after the 1960s in the wake of decolonization and the new social movements and their search for alternative and revisionist histories. I mean, this is what I addressed before when I suggested there were concerns with histories of minorities, histories of women, histories of gays, etc. But the term memory itself was not very dominant at that time at all. I mean, people were not concerned with memory as a key kind of problematic. It was just, there was a kind of historical revisionism, I would say, that was at stake at that time. So the search for other traditions and for the tradition of others was accompanied by multiple statements about endings. There was talk about the end of history. You remember in French post-structuralism, the death of the subject, the death of the artwork, the end of meta-narratives, the end of the méta-récit of Lyotard, and so forth and so on. And in many ways, such claims were frequently understood all too literally. But in their polemical thrust and in their replication of an ethos of avant-gardism, they pointed directly to an ongoing recodification of the past after modernism and after theories of modernism and modernity that had remained, that had been dominant throughout the first half of the 20th century. Thus, of course, for many critics, these types of discussions after the 60s seemed to be postmodern in a genuinely new way. Now, memory discourses then accelerated in Europe and in the United States by the early 1980s. And what triggered the memory discourse at that time was primarily the ever-broadening debate about the Holocaust. And again, one key phenomenon, I think, both in the US and in Germany and perhaps beyond, was a famous American television series with Meryl Streep in 1979, which presented a Jewish family and a German family in the mode of a soap opera. Okay? And those of you old enough to have seen it at the time will remember there was a huge debate over the propriety of representing the Holocaust in a mass cultural narrative. I mean, this is, you know, was the issue. Hayden White would have said, the soap opera, of course, is by now very much another mode of telling history, right? And this event, I think, in 1978 and then Germany in 1979, this television series brought the Holocaust into a much broader public than earlier. And it does not mean, by the way, in the United States, people often said that Germans had repressed the Holocaust until America produced its television program, and then finally they had to face the past. This is complete nonsense. I mean, the Holocaust was always present in Germany, sometimes in unconscious subliminal ways, but also in articulated ways. There were television programs, there were theater plays, there was art that dealt with it, and so forth and so on. But as far as the broad public is concerned, this television series did have a major impact. And it came together then also with, what we've called the testimony movement. I mean, again, in Germany, for instance, people began in the 1980s, young people began to ask questions about Jewish communities in their hometowns. Who were the Jews who were deported from some little Bavarian village, okay, or from Berlin or from Munich? Who were there? Where were the synagogues? Where were the cultural sites? of the Jewish community. So there was a lot of historical work being done at the time, and there was also the sort of emergence into visibility of the, at that time, very small Jewish community in Germany, which numbered only about 10,000. But when I grew up in Germany, for instance, in the 1950s and in the 1960s, the Jewish community that still was there, or again there, was invisible, completely invisible in public. And that changed in the 1980s, and I think this television series had quite something to do with it. Because the soap opera does not talk about big history, it talks about small history, history of families, history of personal relations. And so that triggered debates within families and then also within communities. And that's why I always thought that it was, despite the fact that, you know, the inmates in Auschwitz always looked very well dressed and very well fed, which of course they were not, they looked completely unrealistic in that series. The series itself was a political fact, a political phenomenon of major importance. But then, of course, there was not only this television series. Suddenly, there were all these 40th and 50th anniversaries relating to the history of the Third Reich. And these anniversaries were not just German. They were covered in the media across Europe and the United States. Hitler's rise to power, 1933, 50th anniversary in 1983. Plus, of course, the infamous book burnings of May 1933, also remembered in 1983. And of course, every 10 years then, you had another anniversary. You know, then you had the 60th anniversary, the 70th anniversary. I mean, it's like with the anniversaries of 1968 now. I mean, we just went through the 40th anniversary of 1968. I mean, it seems today that the only way to celebrate or to remember the past is via official anniversaries, which is itself a kind of rather strange phenomenon. Anyway, then you had the memories of the so-called Kristallnacht, Night of Broken Glass, the pogrom of 1938, of November 9th, 1938, which was publicly commemorated in 1988. In 1985, you had the 40th anniversary of the end of World War II, which was also commemorated across Europe. And then again, the 50th one, 10 years later. And you may remember one of these instances where Helmut Kohl, Chancellor of Germany, and François Mitterrand were sort of holding hands. There was the Bitburg affair and so forth. So these memories of the Third Reich and of the Holocaust became central public issues covered widely by the media in the 1980s. Then you had the 50th anniversary of the infamous Wannsee Conference, this lake in Berlin, Wannsee Conference, in which what the Nazis called the final solution, which we call the Holocaust or the Shoah, was decided on in 1942. And it was remembered in 1992 with the opening of a museum in this Wannsee Villa where the conference had taken place in January of 1942. Then the invasion of Normandy of 1944, remembered with grand spectacle by the Allies, but interestingly, without any Russian presence in 1994. I mean, the Russians should have been there, but they were not. Then again, the end of World War II, 1945, etc., etc., 1995, whole series of international events, not only in Europe, but at that point also in Japan. And Japan, of course, was always much slower in coming to terms with its own imperialist past than Europe was. Now, such mostly, in quotes, German anniversaries, replete with the historians' debate of 1986, the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, and German national unification in 1990, received intense coverage, media coverage, across the world. And I think it helped nurture and stir up post-World War II codifications of national history in France, in Austria, in Italy, in Japan, in the United States, and then even in, as we know, in Switzerland. Now, the Holocaust, another aspect, I mean, I'm just listing a number of things here by way of accumulation. The Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington was planned during the 1980s and inaugurated in 1993, gave rise in the United States to a debate about the Americanization of the Holocaust. In other words, the Americanization of a historical phenomenon that did not have much to do with America. Right? So the question was, why didn't America build a museum to slavery or to the genocide of the Native Americans in the Washington Wall? Why a Holocaust museum? Okay, I think it was a good question, but it came and there were, I can talk more perhaps in the discussion session about that, but there were very specific political historical reasons which gave rise to this museum. But then the resonances of Holocaust memory did not stop there. By the end of the 1990s, one can raise the question of to what extent we can now speak, since the end of the 1990s, of something like a globalization of Holocaust discourse. And I'll address that more again in some of my following lectures. Now, all of these public commemorations of World War II and of, you know, the Holocaust, in which I think Spain did not figure, right? I mean, Spain did not figure in that at all, were accompanied by blinding amounts of testimonies, appearances on television of Zeitzeugen, of people in their 70s and their 80s, and says, I lived through it, I saw it, and they were, very verbal and very extensive in giving their testimonies. And I think this had to do, and this is another aspect, with generational realities. I think those generational issues may be something that are pertinent here in Spain at this point as well, in the memories of the Civil War. But in that other context, you know, as I'm sure you know, Holocaust survivors had often not been able or not wanting to speak to their children about their traumatic experiences. But now, at a point in time in the 90s, when the last survivors of the Holocaust, when that generation began to die and to fade out, it loosened their tongue, particularly since the Holocaust discourse became ever more important in the US and in Europe. And often they began to speak. I mean, Holocaust survivors began to speak when they were asked by their grandchildren. In other words, their children had often not asked the questions. There was something subliminal in the families that was not spoken about. But when the grandchildren had seen the Holocaust TV series, they asked, well, what really happened, grandpa or grandma? And so there was a kind of, across the middle generation, there came to be a discussion within families about this past. So this is what, you know, of course, is usually called communicative memory, generational memory. And of course, eventually it also involved the middle generation as well. But there clearly was, and in the Jewish communities in New York, for instance, there clearly was a major shift that I've observed with a lot of in families of friends, a major shift that articulated this kind of change. There is, by the way, a sort of absolutely wonderful book about, you know, survivor generation and their children, or in this case their son, by Art Spiegelman, with the Holocaust comic Mouse, which is a major artwork. I mean, which I can, it's been translated into Spanish, I take it. In Catalan as well, yeah. So at the personal level, at the family level, and then I think such generational dynamics in their relationship to the discourses present in the public media have to be considered as well. But then, in a broader political vein, there were political factors. 1990s, we experienced the recurrence of genocidal politics in Rwanda, in Bosnia, in Kosovo, where they were called, of course, not genocide at first, but ethnic cleansing, and now going on currently in Darfur, in these allegedly post-historical 1990s. And this too, I think, I mean, these events have kept the political memory of the Holocaust, of Holocaust memory alive. They contaminated it and extended it past its original reference points, a reference point in Europe. Now, it is actually interesting to note how in the case of these organized massacres in Rwanda and in Bosnia in the early 1990s, comparisons with the Holocaust were at first fiercely resisted by the politicians, by the media, and by much of the public. People said, no, your breakup of Yugoslavia had nothing to do with the Holocaust. It's just that these people there in the Balkans, they were always primitive. They were always primitive, they were, you know, they always killed each other. Which, of course, as we know as Europeans, is not true. Yugoslavia, there were sort of ethnic tensions, but people did not kill each other. So there was a very simplistic kind of Balkan imaginary, a form of Orientalism in the Western media and among Western politicians that resulted in this faulty thesis. But anyway, the main reason, I think, why, I mean, that was one reason why comparisons were resisted, but then there was also, of course, the need to resist the genocide word, because it would have demanded political intervention, right? It would have demanded political intervention on part of the UN and on part of the Western allies. And political intervention did not happen in Rwanda. Political intervention ultimately did not happen in Bosnia. It happened then when the Kosovo crisis emerged. And this so-called humanitarian intervention in Kosovo by NATO, I would argue, was largely dependent on Holocaust memory, because the images we saw on television were images of streams of refugees across borders, women and children packed into trains for deportation. There were the stories of atrocities, systematic rape, and wanton destruction, all mobilized a politics of guilt in Europe and in the United States, which finally then led to the intervention in the Kosovo conflict. In Germany in particular, I remember in Germany there was always the, you know, the political issue. On the one hand, there was the Nunca Mas, the never again, nie wieder of genocide, and the political, not only the political desire, but the political demand in Germany for the German army never to intervene anywhere outside of its own territory. But it was the Kosovo conflict that changed this line. In Kosovo, first of all, there was the Nie wieder of Auschwitz came to be an argument for intervention in Kosovo. It's a very complicated kind of situation, but as you know, the German army, the German Air Force participated in the Kosovo intervention in the 90s. Anyway, the politics of guilt then that emerged in Europe and in the United States at that time was also associated with the British and French non-intervention in the 1930s, the politics of appeasement. Which might have stopped Hitler. So I think the Kosovo War affirmed ultimately the increasing power of memory culture in the late 1990s, but it also raised very difficult issues about the use of the Holocaust as a universal trope for historical trauma. In other words, we have, and I'll speak more about that tomorrow, we clearly have also an abuse of Holocaust memory for all kinds of different political purposes today. And yet, back to my sort of theoretical point, or historical and theoretical point. I mean, I argue that there was something like a transnational movement of memory in which the Holocaust played an important role in different parts of the world. But this globalization of memory works as well in two other related senses that illustrate what I would call the globalization paradox. The globalization paradox. On the one hand, the Holocaust has become a cipher for the 20th century as a whole and for the failure of the project of enlightenment, the project of la Ilustración. And it serves as proof, to some, of Western civilization's failure to practice memory, to practice anamnesis, the failure of Western civilization to reflect on its constitutive inability to live in peace with difference and with otherness. I mean, think of issues of colonialism, issues of immigration, and so forth and so on. And it serves as proof of Western civilization's failure to draw the consequences from the insidious relationship between enlightened modernity, racial oppression, and organized violence. But now, that's the one side. The other side of the paradox is this. Now, on the other hand, this rather totalizing dimension of Holocaust discourse, which sees the Holocaust basically as the end of Western, as the telos of Western modernity, and this, I think, is prevalent in much postmodern and post-structuralist thought, that is accompanied by a dimension that particularizes and localizes. And it is precisely the emergence of the Holocaust as a universal trope that allows Holocaust memory to latch on to specific local situations that are historically distant from the Holocaust and that are politically distinct from the original event. And I'm thinking of the use of Holocaust narratives in Argentina, for instance, in South Africa, today in India and Pakistan, even in Australia. So in this transnational movement of memory discourses, the Holocaust loses its quality as an index of a specific historical event, and it begins to function as a metaphor for other traumatic histories and other memories. The Holocaust as universal trope is the prerequisite for its decentering and its use as a powerful prism through which we may look back at other instances of genocide. The global and the local of Holocaust memory have entered into new constellations that need to be analyzed case by case. Now, while the comparison with the Holocaust may rhetorically energize some discourses of traumatic memory, as it did, for instance, in Argentina, and I'll speak about that in the lecture this afternoon, it may also serve as screen memory or simply block insight into specific local histories. Now, as I'm speaking here to a Spanish Catalonian audience, I'm very much aware of the fact that this Holocaust discourse is not central to the Spanish situation. Because here the issue of memory, of course, I mean, if it is, let me know, but my impression is that it is not. What is important here, of course, is the history of a civil war, which is a different kind of problematic. It is not the problematic of a sort of, let's say, national local population against its own minorities or minorities elsewhere, but it is the history of a domestic conflict within. But what it does have in common, of course, with some of the situations elsewhere in the world, I would suggest, and we can discuss that, is that it happened after a dictatorship. The memories of the past emerge, not suddenly, but over a period of time. The memories of the past emerge when suddenly the people feel the need to talk about a past that was probably in Spain much less repressed, I imagine, than the Holocaust past was repressed in Germany. So this kind of, if I talk here so much about the Holocaust, I'm trying to set things up for the more sort of global, international kind of debates that I will address in my other lectures, later today and tomorrow. But then when it comes to what I call present pasts, pasados presentes, the memory of the Holocaust and its place in the reassessment of Western modernity, its reassessment within Western Enlightenment, is not the whole story. There are many more subplots, smaller plots, that make up the current memory narrative in its broadest scope, and that distinguish our times quite clearly from earlier decades of this century. And let me just list here a few of the salient phenomena. And I've addressed this in my, these phenomena in my book, En Busca del Futuro Perdido, which is a collection of essays pertinent to the topic that was published a few years ago in Argentina. So let me list a few of the phenomena. I mean, since the 1970s, in Europe and the United States, we have had the historicizing restoration of old urban centers. We have had whole museum villages and museum landscapes. We've had various national heritage and patrimony enterprises. We've had a wave of new museum architecture that shows no signs of receding. And sometimes I've had the feeling the only new thing that gets built these days are museums. I mean, there's a marked absence of new civic architecture, for instance. Museums, of course, are part of civic architecture, but they're more dominant than ever. We've had a boom in retro fashions, a boom in repro furniture, reproduction furniture, which of course always markets itself as being authentic, which it is not by way of definition. We've had a mass marketing of nostalgias. We have the obsessive self-musealization per video recorder, or camcorder, as they're called these days. So we all participate in this phenomenon. We've had memoir writing. I mean, if I look at the book review of the New York Times every Sunday, I mean, about at least a third or half of the reviews are about memoirs or memories of this, that, or the other thing. We've had confessional literature all the way to the internet phenomenon of Facebook. We have the autobiography, the rise of autobiographies. I mean, people these days write their memoirs and autobiographies when they barely have reached the age of 30. I mean, there's a whole literature in Germany now, Berlin pop literature, that operates in this mode. And then, of course, we have the postmodern historical novel with its uneasy negotiation between fact and fiction. A recent example would be Jonathan Littell's Les Bienveillants. We've had the spread of memory practices in the visual arts, which are often centered on the medium of photography. And we've had the increase of historical documentaries on television, including in the United States, a whole private channel, which is called the History Channel. We usually call it the Hitler Channel, because, the Third Reich and the Holocaust and, the liberation of Europe by the U.S. Army is so central to it. And then on the traumatic side of memory culture, and beside the ever more ubiquitous Holocaust discourse, we have a vast psychoanalytic literature on trauma, not only trauma relating to the Holocaust, but trauma relating to what was called recovered memory syndrome, when people claimed that they were abused as children, for instance, and which caused a huge debate some years ago. We have the historical and current work related to genocide anywhere in the world, the debate about AIDS, about slavery, about sexual abuse. We have the ever more numerous public controversies about politically painful anniversaries, which I already addressed, commemorations, and the building of memorials in addition to the building of museums. We have the latest plethora of apologies for the past by church leaders and politicians in France, in Japan, in the United States, and so forth and so on. And we have the legal proceedings for restitution. In other words, the memory discourse, of course, is in interesting ways linked to legal discourses about, about restitution, about redress, and about human rights. And then, of course, some years ago, bringing together memory entertainment and memory and trauma, we had the worldwide obsession with the sinking of a presumably unsinkable steamship that anticipated the end of another Gilded Age, which we are currently witnessing as a financial and economic shipwreck. In other words, I'm suggesting, tongue-in-cheek somewhat, to see the Titanic movie as a kind of anticipation of what is happening now exactly in these days with a financial collapse. So indeed, one cannot be quite sure whether the international success of the film about the Titanic was a metaphor for memories of modernity gone awry, or whether it actually articulated the metropolis's own anxieties about the future, which we have reached now, displaced to the past. But anyway, to conclude here, the world is being musealized, and we all play our parts in it. I'm very aware of that. I'm playing my part in it as an academic who keeps writing about memory, although sometimes I don't want to do it anymore. I keep getting invitations to talk about memorial discourse, and I'm happy to accept them and to continue with this work. But so the question is then to cite another title of another movie. Is the goal here total recall? Is the goal total recall? Is this an archivist's fantasy gone crazy, gone mad? Or is there perhaps something else at stake in this desire to pull all these various pasts into the present? Something that is indeed specific to the structuring of memory and temporality today, and that has not been experienced in the same way in past ages. In other words, does the memory discourse actually say something about our age that makes our age very special? And this is, of course, the big and difficult question, which I'll have to leave unanswered for now, and perhaps for quite some time to come. Thank you. Okay, so we can have questions. I hate these machines. I always have trouble with these machines. So if you can ask your questions in Castellano, if this is possible, I can. Catalano comprendo demasiado bien. I will try to understand, and if not, Gabriel will help me. Yes?
Yo quería felicitarle porque ha tratado tantísimos temas con respecto a la memoria que parece casi recordar el fantasma que recorría Europa de Marx. Ahora es la construcción de memorias de distintos tipos como un fenómeno nuevo. Lo que sí que quería puntualizar, porque para un antropólogo ha habido quizá, cuando has realizado la historia intelectual de la historia oral y todas estas cuestiones, claro, los antropólogos siempre hemos tratado a gente sin escritura. Y que, así como en líneas generales es muy correcto toda el panorama intelectual que has trazado, Vilar, entre los posmodernos, el interés de los historiadores por la historia oral. Yo creo que hay toda una gama muy amplia.
De, ¿una gama qué quiere decir?
Nuance, ¿no? De, okay. De intelectuales, antropólogos, uh-huh. Y sobre todo clasicistas, ¿no? De griego o algo así, que se plantearon en otros términos la oral literacy controversia sobre, pues no sé, recordar por ejemplo a Harlow en el prefacio a Platón, y entre los antropólogos a Jack Goody y su tratamiento de en qué consistía un discurso oral, que no tiene nada que ver cuando la gente no sabe escribir con la historia oral de los historiadores, porque la historia oral de los historiadores es registrada, uh-huh. Y la oralidad como técnica consiste en que, como no es registrada, se está alterando continuamente, ¿no? Entonces, uh-huh. Para los antropólogos que luego nos dedicamos a este tipo de cuestiones, partimos de esta otra tradición que yo creo que ha aportado muchas cosas en el debate.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and I think it's an important distinction to make, the distinction between, a kind of a discipline like anthropology that deals with histories without writing, even though, of course, the question is how you describe writing. And, I mean, I remember Lévi-Strauss in Triste Tropique, for instance, who argues that there is some form of writing, but it is a different form of writing. I mean, I'm using the Derridean kind of interpretation, that there is a form of writing, except it does not take, it is not the writing in letters. But be that as it may, I think the difference between the work that you do as an anthropologist and what the oral historian does, who registers, you know, who writes down the interviews they take, even in the present today, is an important difference to see. But I think, the question I would ask, isn't there in contemporary anthropology or ethnography even a kind of confluence, a kind of coming together of, of the oral and the written?
A ver, yo creo que en la antropología también fue muy dominante en estos años 80 toda la actitud posmodernista con respecto a los discursos, por ejemplo, pues, uh-huh. A partir de Clifford Geertz, sobre todo, y sus thick descriptions. Pero hablando sobre el tema de los genocidios, Clifford Geertz estaba en Indonesia cuando se producía un gran genocidio, el de todos los comunistas, que fueron, sí, 500.000 o 1 millón de personas, y él habló de las peleas de gallos en Bali.
Sí, 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 no hablaba de esto, sí.
Era una, sí, omisión muy grande, y eso, sí, inició esto posmoderno.
Sí.
Entonces, claro, lo que hicieron antropólogos como Jack Goody, siguiendo pues otra gente de crítica literaria, como pueden ser los canadienses tipo Walter Ong o algo así, es mirar las implicaciones técnicas de la escritura y la oralidad.
Sí.
Y entonces, claro, tenemos que saber que la mayoría de los genocidios se están produciendo no en grandes sociedades, sino dentro de estados, en pequeños grupos, por ejemplo, en la Amazonía, y el número de pueblos exterminados de los que antes estudiábamos los antropólogos es muy alto.
Right.
No llega a la escala, porque la población no son escalas.
Because, yeah.
Es realmente estremecedor. No, en ese sentido, los antropólogos que a mí me interesaron sobre esto consideraron la oralidad y la escritura técnicas de comunicación, y que cada una de las técnicas, tú decías, es como, la oralidad es como el arado. O sea,
¿cómo el qué?
El arado, el plow, para el intelecto. Es, uh-huh, uno piensa con unas técnicas diferentes.
Uh-huh.
Y también tenemos ahora una revolución en la comunicación muy grande, como es Facebook, Internet y todo esto, y acabaremos pensando posiblemente de otra manera, como cuando ocurrió la imprenta y difundió lo escrito.
Uh-huh.
Y entonces, claro, no podemos abstraer los elementos técnicos para obtener conocimiento de cómo nos comunicamos. Y recuerdo ahora un ejemplo que ponía Woody, el Padre Nuestro, como la religión católica tiene una comunidad por escrito, es igual en todo el mundo católico. El mito de los Lodagaa cambia en cada generación y los dioses aparecen y desaparecen.
Entonces,
claro, lo oral no está fijo y se altera. Es muy posmoderno lo oral en ese sentido.
Sí, es verdad. Sí.
Pero lo escrito es fijo y nosotros en el proyecto ilustrado partimos de lo escrito. Entonces, estas cuestiones técnicas a mí me parecen relevantes.
Sí.
Nada más.
No, I take it as a comment, as a very pertinent kind of comment. The only thing I might want to add is that written texts, of course, are also never that stable because they do get rewritten. You know, they do get rewritten all the time. So they may be stable for a certain amount of time, but ultimately they lose their stability, I think, perhaps not on the page where they're written, but they do lose their stability in the heads of the readers. Because I would make that argument as a literary critic, drawing on reception theory, right? When you have literary works which do not change on the page, you have final editions of the works of Cervantes, of Goethe, of quien sea, you have the final editions, but the reception, what is being done with these texts in the head of readers, constantly changes. So, yeah. Yeah. Bueno, gracias. ¿Otra pregunta o comentario? No, one other thing I would want to say, I mean, this, of course, I'm a modernist, right? So I see anthropology from afar. Well, maybe how Gert saw the, you know, in Indonesia, how he saw the sort of internal kind of massacres of communists and of the left in Indonesia at the time from afar, or was not interested in it. But this relationship between the oral and the written, I think we have to expand also in terms of media theory to include the image, right? I mean, there is and the image, the relationship between word and image is sort of codified also in a very traditional kind of hierarchy, you know, where the word usually is privileged over and against the image. And of course there are cultures in which the image becomes more important than the word. And then you can add, ultimately you would also have to add the oral dimension, the dimension of sound. And it makes it all very complicated, but I think that's the challenge we have as cultural historians or as literary critics, art critics today, to, you know, consider our own work in, you know, the work of literary criticism, for instance, in the context of other media or of other expressions of media. Anyway, just an afterthought.
Sí, pero ahora me sugerías, por ejemplo, en la película esta que se llama Shoah, la de las 9 horas, ¿no?
El Landsman, sí.
Sí. Siempre, claro, queda como si eso fuera la verdad, porque son imágenes fijas, cuando uno, claro, ve exactamente la construcción narrativa que
Exacto.
hace Landsman,
yeah.
y entonces queda como un poco paradójica, ¿no? Es,
yeah.
que es esta película que se llama Shoah, que dura 9 horas, donde lo único que van haciendo, excepto 4 o 5 imágenes, es entrevistar a los supervivientes. Entonces, para mucha gente parece que es una cosa casi bíblica, que dices, esto es la verdad, porque
yeah.
es un poco un soporte de lo que tú anunciabas que estaba pasando. Y sin embargo, es una película con muchas construcciones, como todos los documentales. Es decir, no hay ningún documental que sea la verdad. Todos los documentales tienen técnicas narrativas que no tienen por qué ser tramposas, pero que están ahí contándonos también las cosas.
Mm. But of course it was predicated on the notion that only interviewing survivors, as you say, that gives us the truth, and that is the only mode of representation that the Holocaust, that the Shoah would allow. Direct representation, mimetic representation, is, according to Landsman, would not be permitted, would not be allowed. And it has to do with this, which I think is a phantasm, I mean this thesis that of the unrepresentability of the Holocaust. I mean, historians would immediately disagree, for good reason. The Holocaust is, as anything else is, you know, is representable. And then Lanzmann actually says it's not really a... The counterexample to Lanzmann, of course, was the Spielberg film Schindler's List. And Schindler's List, I always defended Schindler. I mean, I think Lanzmann's work is a great work. It's a great piece of art. Schindler's List is a Hollywood movie. But I would always want to defend the value of Schindler's List, of bringing the Holocaust to a much larger audience, to people who will never spend 9 hours watching Lanzmann's interviews. The other thing you say is also important. There is a performative contradiction in I assume many people know the film, right? There's a performative contradiction in Lanzmann's film. There is a narrative, as you say, and there's a visual narrative, right? I mean, it begins in the killing fields of Chełmno, and it ends where? In the Yad Vashem, in Jerusalem. So there's a very clear kind of narrative trajectory, and the hero of that trajectory is Claude Lanzmann in his self-representation. Okay.